Good evening. Hear that better this time? Thank you. So I thought I would talk tonight about enlightenment. When I first started practicing Buddhism, I had heard a certain amount about enlightenment, and I thought that's what we were going for, and that it would happen. Anyone else have that experience? Yeah. And you know, there are these enlightenment stories of people doing seated meditation and being on retreats and having a sudden awakening experience of somewhat mysterious source and rushing out to tell their teacher of what had happened and having their experience of enlightenment or kensho confirmed by the teacher. And I think that does happen in the Rinzai Zen tradition, or at least in some things that I have read about that tradition. So I thought that was going to happen to us sitting in Zen, Soto Zen centers too, although for quite a long time it was just a great big challenge to sit still for the period of Zazen. So that was what I was working on doing. And I think in a way that our view, or my understanding of our view of enlightenment, is what I'm thinking about all the time. And that is how to realize our complete interconnection with all of life. That I am working on all the time. Also, I think a model for that other view of enlightenment is the story of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, and as we are told the story, we can't possibly know the real story since it is so lost and beyond any history, but we are told of a vow to sit until he became enlightened or had a complete understanding of the nature of reality, which is one way it was taught to us. And then we are told that on seeing the morning star after sitting for a very long time, he did have that complete understanding, and there are various, some quite fanciful stories of what that understanding was. But the simple story, I think, from in our tradition, is that he understood that all is a complete, ever-changing, moving, interconnected thing. My teacher, my main teacher in Zen Buddhism, was a student of Suzuki Roshi's. So when he was very young, he started to listen and be present with Suzuki Roshi. And so the main teaching that I got for years and years was not the beautiful, complex words of Dogen that we hear here, but the simple words of Suzuki Roshi. Memories, quotes, passages from talks, etc. So I realize, as I think some of you know, that I've had quite some enlightenment experiences around Dogen in this very room with Kokyo explaining things in a way that, aha, I finally got it. So having had that experience, to go back to Suzuki Roshi's simple words has been very, very thrilling, really. So there is a talk that in Zen mind, beginner's mind, is the word breathing is used at the beginning of the talk. And some of you may know this very well. I love to read it again and again. Suzuki Roshi said, "When we practice Zazen, our mind always follows our breathing. When we inhale, the air comes into the inner world. When we exhale, the air goes out to the outer world. The inner world is limitless, and the outer world is also limitless. We say inner world or outer world, but actually there is just one whole world. In this limitless world, our throat is like a swinging door. The air comes in and goes out like someone passing through a swinging door. If you think I breathe, the I is extra. There is no you to say I. What we call I is just a swinging door which moves when we inhale and when we exhale. It just moves, that is all. When your mind is pure and calm enough to follow this movement, there is nothing. No I, no world, no mind, nor body, just a swinging door. So when we practice Zazen, all that exists is the movement of the breathing, but we are aware of the movement." So he then goes on to say that this just isn't Zazen, but this is all of our life. This is what is happening. Zazen is just the place to concentrate on, as he is often quoted to say, things as it is. When we become truly ourselves, we just become a swinging door, and we are purely independent of and at the same time dependent upon everything. Without air, we cannot breathe. Each one of us is in the midst of myriads of worlds. We are in the center of the world always, moment after moment. So we are completely dependent and independent. If you have this kind of experience, this kind of existence, you have absolute independence. You will not be bothered by anything. Which is quite something to say. So when you practice Zazen, your mind should be concentrated on your breathing. This kind of activity is the fundamental activity of the universal being. With this experience, this practice, it is impossible. Without this experience, this practice, it is impossible to attain absolute freedom. You know, there's all this talk about mindfulness in our lives these days. Mindfulness is a very, very powerful practice. And without mindfulness, without actually being right here, completely in this body and place and breathing, and here we are all together, there is no way to realize the enlightenment, the understanding of being the door that opens and closes and is not separate from everything. So mindfulness reduces pain. Mindfulness makes it easier to eat sensibly. Mindfulness does so many things in our lives, and mindfulness is the key to enlightenment. So I have a very busy mind. Some of you may be aware of that. And I have a life which involves a lot of activities, a lot of busyness. If I don't consult my calendar, I'm in trouble because I'm sure to miss something that I was supposed to do. So now when I sit, I can sit that is a big change over my initial efforts to sit zazen. I mean, I looked like, might have looked like I was sitting, but I was having great difficulty being a still body and sitting for a 40-minute period. But I still have a very busy mind and have the challenge of finding that breath in and the breath out, and keeping my mind on that. So on Friday mornings, I go to Berkeley to have a special afternoon activity with my 5-year-old granddaughter. And I go there early on Friday mornings because there is a Hindu yoga teacher, a very devout practitioner of Hindu yoga, who starts basically a yoga class with a Dharma talk, and all of yoga is an example of whatever the Dharma talk was about. And this is extremely helpful to this busy mind. So I thought I might try to share with you, although when he speaks I think, oh, I will never, ever be able to say things like he says them. But he asks us to sit comfortably and to pay attention to our breath. And it's, of course, quiet. And so we are paying, all of us, attention to our breath. And he suggests then that we breathe in to a count of 4 and breathe out to a count of 8. So once you've achieved that one time, of course, it's much easier because you have had such a significant exhalation that your inhalation is much, much better than it was the first time around. So we do this for a while, and we might just try that for a while. And then while we're doing that, he rings a bell. And our job is to keep on breathing in to a count of 4 and out to a count of 8. If you can do it, otherwise use any numbers that will work for you. I think the oldest person in this class I take on Friday mornings is about 95. She kind of holds on to the wall during some of the yoga, but she does everything, including this. So continue with your breathing, and then pay attention to the beginning and all of the sound of the bell until it disappears from your hearing. So the challenge of not only following our own breath, but following yet another thing going on. And some people in Zazen follow their own breath and follow whatever sounds are happening, from the garbage truck to the wind to the anything that is happening. That powerful practice enables us to stay centered in this opening, closing door, being with everything, even when extremely annoying things happen and we might want to hold together our ego and say something. So this is something to that I'm thinking about. This kind of concentration which follows two things at once. So the practices in Zen centers like this one are, I think, a grand design for bringing us mindfully into the present. When you're new here, I think you're not aware of quite all the little mindfulness tricks that are lacing the environment. We cross that threshold of that door with our foot closest to the door jamb. So it's a crossing over, stepping then with the other foot, hands together and bowing. We make a decision whether we're going to come on that side of the altar or on this side of the altar. If we're coming on this side, we bow at the altar at the back of this altar right here, and then we find a seat here. If we get to one of these sides and we decide we want to be on the other side, we go all the way back behind the altar and start again. If we find there's a cushion we need or something, we go behind the altar. All this keeping our attention on where are we in this space. Then, of course, when we get to our seat, we bow to the seat. We arrange the seat. We bow to the seat. We bow away from the seat. We sit down quietly, etc. In the morning, when it's dark and quiet, and we're sitting, we can hear the quiet steps of the doshi entering and the quiet rustle of the doshi bowing at the mat. And walking to the altar and offering incense, and then eventually the three bells of the doshi sitting down. As we were tonight, you were aware of my coming in and bowing at the altar, offering incense, bowing at the altar, and coming to sit down. As we're doing service in the early mornings or service at the end of our periods of Zazen in the evening, we do various things in unison and we find the voices of the others to chant in unison. It was a perfect example, I think, in the chant before I started talking, because there was a wide range of notes on which we were chanting and there was a bit of dissonance. And then in the second line, we came together and we were one. So that's also another kind of mindfulness that happens to us here. And we will go on and eventually we will bow out in unison and walk our way out in our usual way, taking turns to turn around and bow at the door. So in all of our centers, this is what we do. And there are the sounds of our practice and the movements of our practice and the customs of our practice. And they all call us to being present right in this moment. And in the midst of all this, we sit Zazen. So it's our job in Zazen to still our active bodies and to still our busy minds, to find each of us our body on the cushion or the chair, to find our breath coming in and going out, and to follow it. To discover that we're distracted with thoughts and to return to following our breath. This is the path to our kind of enlightenment. Only if we are still and aware of our own breathing body, which is enlightenment central for all of us, can we be aware that we are a swinging door, that we are not separate beings but one with all life. Now here at Santa Cruz Zen Center and at all, I find this so touching and so wonderful. At other Soto Zen Centers throughout the world, at Soto Zen Centers in Japan and in China, we chant sutras as part of our early morning service. And Zen and Chan temples chant the Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra every morning, beginning with, when deeply practicing Prajna Paramita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. And at Soto Zen temples many mornings, we chant something written by Dogen, who was the 13th century Japanese Zen Buddhist teacher who founded our school. So in Japan and in here and in Europe and everywhere that we have our kind of temple, we chant. And over again in his in the words that come down to us from Dogen, Dogen expresses how we are one with all things. So each week here we chant, and each day at Tassajara during practice period, I think, we chant. Grass, trees, and lands which are embraced by this teaching together radiate a great light and endlessly expound the inconceivable profound Dharma. Grass, trees, and walls bring forth the teaching for all beings, common people as well as sages, and they in accord extend this Dharma for the sake of grass, trees, and walls. This, the realm of self-awakening and awakening others, invariably holds the mark of realization with nothing lacking, and realization itself is manifested without ceasing for a moment. Suzuki Roshi, of course, said the same thing, but in much simpler words. So our enlightenment in Zen Buddhism is sometimes called experiencing Buddha nature. Realizing that speech is crude and our thoughts are limited by the concreteness of much of our experience, still we try to speak, to use words to express this thing. Dogen held that Buddha nature was simply the true nature of reality and being. Actually, you know, Dogen didn't hesitate with those words, did he? We worry about it sometimes, but the founder of our school was amazing with words. This true nature was just impermanence, becoming, and vast emptiness. Emptiness not meaning there's nothing there. Emptiness meaning that in the fullness of being, nothing is independent and permanent. All is changing and not separate. Because he saw the whole universe as an expression of Buddha nature, he held that even grass and trees are Buddha nature. Thinking about these things leads one to return again and again to the concept of Buddha nature. Karl Bielefeld, who's a really wonderful scholar of Dogen, wrote an introduction to this fascicle of Dogen's called Buddha Nature. Bielefeld wrote, "The concept of Buddha nature, one of the most widely discussed topics in East Asian Buddhism, was subject to a wide range of interpretations. In his opening remarks, Dogen dismisses several of the most common views: that the Buddha nature is the potential to become a Buddha, that it is the activity of cognition within us, or that it is a universal self pervading the world. Rather, he says, the Buddha nature is existence itself, not an abstract principle of being, but the actual occurrence of things, or as he puts it simply at the end of his essay, fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles. Yasutani Roshi said, everything by its very nature is subject to the process of infinite transformation. This is its Buddha or Dharma nature. And you know, I seem to be quoting these Rinzai people from whom I got this mistaken idea about enlightenment, but they are the word, theirs are the words that mean a great deal to me in understanding this. Philip Kaplow wrote, it is that which is living, dynamic, devoid of mass, unfixed, beyond individuality or personality, the matrix of all phenomena. Therefore, the very impermanency of grass and tree, thicket and forest, is Buddha nature. The very impermanency of people and things, body and mind, is Buddha nature. Nature and lands, mountains and rivers are impermanent because they are Buddha nature. Supreme and complete enlightenment, because it is impermanent, is Buddha nature. In thinking about our practice, about the breath, the sitting, the breath in, the breath out, the everything together, I also think about the other practices which some of us practice, which have arisen out of Soto Zen Buddhism. One is Japanese tea ceremony, which I have studied quite a bit. I think I was the most inept of all Japanese tea ceremony students, but I love it nevertheless. How many here have ever practiced Japanese tea ceremony? Not everybody. Sometimes you will have a chance, and when you do have the invitation, please say yes. There is a simple room. Occasionally this zendo has been converted into such a simple room. Occasionally the Dokusan room in the building over there in the corner. At Green Gulch Farm there is a tea house devoted, a garden around it, and a tea house devoted to tea ceremony. Various places do it various ways. The first time I ever did it, I was practicing at a Korean Zen temple in Chicago, and one of our senior practitioners practiced tea ceremony, and he invited some of us over to his apartment to have tea. The whole dining room was a tea room. He had made a tea room out of soji paper, and you crawled in, and the window of the tea house was located right next to the window to the dining room, so you had a very much a sense of window, but you were inside the tea house. You were no longer in his apartment, and he served tea. It was to me such a touching, simple, bringing you completely peacefully to the present experience, that when it was time to leave, I didn't want to leave the room. He crawled out first, and then my other friend crawled out, and I stayed for a while, and then I decided, you know, that I actually had to do what I was told and crawl out and enjoy their company. So in this kind of a very simple room that is created for tea ceremony, one stills and is aware of everything in the room. You notice an altar and flowers that have been prepared in the altar. You notice the way in which the tea is being prepared, the bowls that are used, the various implements that are used. The person who is making tea is exquisitely aware of every movement and following a ritual of movement that has been taught in that tradition. Exactly, exactly. So that person prepares one bowl of green tea at a time and places it in front of you if you are the recipient, and you receive it and place it right in front of yourself. And you will have eaten a very sweet mochi pastry, and then you will drink this tea. That is a very, it is very difficult in tea ceremony to be other than in the tea ceremony. Haiku is another. Many people in our tradition write these very simple poems to a haiku formula. And one of the really very special writers of these is Mitsu Suzuki, Suzuki Roshi's widow. And this, she published this one when she was 100. And you could turn to any page in this book. It's called A White Tea Bowl, and she was, is probably still, a devout practitioner of tea ceremony. But just almost at random, to take three of her haiku. His portrait smiles, a single camellia blossom. This is, to me, being so very completely present. Spring, midday, in my solitude, the familiar cuckoo clock. Dreaming all night long, fragrance of peach blossoms. Bless her. Here we have zazen. We have service. We have crickets. What a blessing. And we have life as it unfolds. There was a irreverent and profound 14th century Japanese poet and Zen teacher named Ikkyu, always averse to the usual ways of seeing things. So this person especially treasures his words. Every day, he wrote, or said, and someone else wrote it down, priests minutely examine the law and endlessly chant complicated sutras. Before doing that, though, they should learn how to read the love letters sent by the wind and rain, the snow and moon. And I say amen to that. So this is, you know, a Dharma talk for Hannah. This is what I talk to myself about. This is what I need to think about and understand. And I am so very curious whether you all think about this kind of thing, or what lessons you might offer for me to think about, since I get stuck in this particular kind of realm. So So I will stop talking, and I've allowed a nice... I got to say everything I wanted to say, and I would treasure if anyone feels like sharing what's up for them. Thank you. Patrick. You know, the stories they tell those who were treated to tea with her when she lived at Zen Center is of a very soft touch. This is not the doctrinaire tea ceremony lady. This is a kinder, gentler form of tea and love and sympathy and understanding. Very the feeling they have, those people who were treated to her kindnesses is... very tender and dear. Yeah. Yeah. Carolyn.
Suddenly, having to Catholic came to my mind. I felt this so strongly when we were driving back from Chasahara one time, and we stopped in Watsonville at the Japanese pastry shop, where she could have her special sweet mochi, perhaps?
Yes.
Which was a rare treat for her because she couldn't have sweets otherwise. But I remember that moment of great sweetness and presence with Catherine just at that time. And I think that her mountain seat ceremony, which many of us remember, was such a welcoming occasion. She welcomed everyone, remembers all the different spirits who came to join us, including the cats and the crickets, and everyone who came in because of our interdependence and relationships with each other. Somehow I feel very good tonight as you speak about these different ways of being present.
That's beautiful, Carolyn, thank you. We carry these memories, you know. I mean, there's a lot of people in the room who we don't see, but we feel. I feel people in the room. And we have other beings almost in the room. I mean, the cats and the past cats, and how beautiful. Ellen and I went to that shop fairly recently. Dana went there fairly recently. Yummy stuff to be had at that place. I think you can. I think it's harder. So maybe you practice slow and then you get faster. But sometimes things are fast. you know. I'm thinking the trick is not to get distracted into thought, but to stay with the what's happening. If I suppose if thinking is what's happening, that's what you're thinking about. But I'm thinking about the way people so powerfully use mindfulness to deal with pain. Because when we're in pain, we experience being in pain. But pain actually changes. And if we follow the changes that occur, the ebb and flow, we experience periods of welcome relief from the intensity of pain. So I think there are, that would be one example of trying to stay with the moments as they come, fast or slow. I don't know, what do other people think? You experts in mindfulness? Yeah, but you are... Yeah, it's only a period of time until they will be talking mindfulness in the state booklet, right? It's everywhere else.
But it was just so exquisite that I felt myself being mindful of the situation after arriving at the problems came and I saw the flow. So I was just wondering if it was mindfulness or was it just happenstance that it all came so conclusively.
One can't control these things, alas, but how beautiful. And some of it was fast, and some of it probably was slow. And
some of it was mindfulness, and
I don't know. How beautiful to know that happened today. How old were they? A little louder so Jean can hear you. Yeah.
One of the things that is happening for me is that as my ability to be more mindful increases, and certainly as an artist, that paying attention, especially when I'm drawing or looking at something, the intensity with which I do that, it
becomes more expansive, and then it can be more distracted. I can get distracted because another something calls to be paid, be mindful of. There's like a continuum of things that ask for my attention. And I struggle with the distraction because it's so much. It's so much.
In the middle, you're interrupted with the thought of it's...
I don't even know if it's thought, it's perception. You know, and the words of, I hear something, I see something, I feel something. And it's like, I want to touch the paper in a way that's mindful. At the same time, I'm hearing something that I want to hear it fully. And so this idea of going fast or slow, you can only pay attention to so much. But there's so much to pay attention to. How does that work? How do you stay focused? To be mindful and stay focused when there's so much. Well, I'm just telling you my problem. It's a distraction. It's a joyful distraction. But it's
sounds pretty joyful. You're seeing, hearing.
And then we hear these words of, no eyes, no, oh, no ears, no, you know. Like, what? I don't get this. No body, no mind, and yet it's so full.
That's what it's about, is that it's so full. It's fullness, not emptiness. You know? And you are, you're full of fullness. Well, you'll have to just talk to other artists, I think. It will be very interesting. Maybe over tea people will share what they, you know, my stuff is like close focusing with a camera. So then you just go like, wah, you know, and then you're on to the next one. Jean, you thought you might want to say something a little bit ago.
Yes, I have some of the other questions and comments I have for that one.
Oh, darn. Okay. Richard.
You think of everything, I think, now in terms of then, to a duality of some sort or a paradox of some sort of holding two things. And you know, you have the no mind, you have the spontaneity that you hopefully start to reach or touch in sitting and stopping the mind. And then you have rational thinking and functional thinking and having to function in the day and being creative, not spontaneously, but doing work, career. And then mind. What I come up with in terms of looking away and holding the two, you know, that there is a thinking mind. You will
So how do you do that? How do you practice so that?
I think that's, to me, what practice is you create that base, and then if you need to have concentration or discipline or an intention that you're going to follow through on, there is a frontal lobe that it can be used for cognitive activity of the world. Mm-hmm. But there's a way of doing that in a space. I mean, for me, the example is always music. But and the people I learn from talk about Zen, and they say before you start practicing, get find, breathe, settle, find your space. You know, that means okay, I have practice. I've made it so that I've stopped doing. I've stopped letting any kind of visual thinking about wanting to be right and be good and do this and to be good, just settle down and then start doing it. But so there's that move away of doing things, which is doing, you know. And you can think and construct. If you can do it breathing, it's the way you had a sleep you can do once before. You know, that's how my idea of my practice is. What I need to work on is that quiet, you know, harmonious, equanimous, non-judging place, non-thinking. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I can think, and in that somewhere, I think about summarizing it, that's one of the words that we talk about that, but that's how, for me, the practice is. And then you bring that practice. I bring that practice if I can. Especially if I'm music, I have to. Because otherwise I get nothing. It's just, I waste my time. It's just, you know.
So I think I would translate that you're starting with Zazen.
Right.
And Zazen is a movable feast. It's not just here on the cushion, but throughout our lives. We stop and sense our presence and our breath and sense this opening and closing door in which we are with all. And then there's something we have to do, and if we do it out of that, realization, that's what you're talking about. Yeah. Okay. Mary.
When I think about presence, when I think about interconnectedness, generosity, warmth, tenderness, you're the inspiration for that. You're the perfect example for that. In all of my interactions with you, you're fully present. You're completely interconnected. There's no separation. And when I think about practice, that's what I think about is that mindfulness, that presence, that interconnectedness. I actually think about it more than it's not in the realm of what I think about for practice. I look at trying to follow a precept and not trying to be and no way to path, and I think I can get beyond that to think about the mindfulness. But you're fully present and mindful.
Well, it's a little embarrassing because it's easy to do that with you. It isn't easy to do that with everybody in my life. But thank you, Mary. Oh, boy. Well, the grocery clerk's a little easy, too. It's
the person that you're upset with or that you're disagreeing with.
Yeah. Yeah, I it's a little, it's the provocateur in me that headlines enlightenment. You know, it's a big term. And it is a term that I was bothered by early in my practice because I was supposed to do this, achieve this thing. And, you know, mostly I just had great difficulty sitting still and pain in my knees, etc. But I think actually that what you were talking about is our version of it, you know. And it's just being a little provocative to use those that long word. It's totally unnecessary. It's I just like to be a little provocative sometimes. Okay. Are we done? Okay. So I hope we can talk a little later over some tea or whenever. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.